In preparation for Elul. When we met last week, so what we saw is that Torah is a relationship. It's not a religion. And our whole goal is to make sure that the relationship is ideal, that there is a wonderful, thriving, healthy relationship between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, us and other people, and ideally also between our body and our soul. Now, we also spoke last week about how Elul is the time for rebuilding relationships. That's where we left off. It's the period of Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li. A question which must have occurred to you since last week, if you understand that all we're doing now is we're rebuilding our relationship, the question which must have occurred to you is, if the whole goal here is intimacy and closeness, then why does Elul lead right into such a scary time during the year? It doesn't seem like we're preparing for closeness. It seems like we're preparing for terror. Yeah, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. So before we get deeply into our Elul preparations, I want to try to understand, what is the place of awe in normal, healthy relationships? That perhaps will give us the perspective to properly frame and align our Elul Avoda. The problem with trying to solve questions like what is the place of awe in intimate relationships is always where in the Torah do you look for it? The Torah is not well indexed. But I believe that at least one makor that we can look at today to try to understand the place of awe in relationships is the scene where Moshe has finished the construction of the Mishkan, the mobile temple that was used in the desert. And he's handed this instrument, the Mishkan, this mobile temple, over to his brother Aaron. And he tells his brother Aaron, okay, you're the priest, take over, turn the thing on. So in this extraordinary scene, Aaron goes in and he starts begging HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please send fire down from heaven. And Aaron is trying and trying and trying, and it's not working. Aaron's two sons, Nadav and Avihu, are standing on the sidelines watching. And as they're there on the sidelines, they're sitting there with a bottle. Yeah?
Whiteboard,
that's fine. They're sitting there with a bottle and they're drinking. Not Aiden water, but they're drinking vodka. And they're getting completely stoned drunk. Halfway through the scene, Aaron's begging for fire to come down from heaven. His sons are drinking. They suddenly get up, pick up fire pans, put a bunch of hot coals in these fire pans, and they run straight past their father Aaron, right into the Kadosh Kadoshim. There they take the fire pans and they put these hot coals on the altar in the Kadosh Kadoshim. Immediately, two beams of fire descend from heaven. They start heading towards the Kadosh Kadoshim. Not even if they look up, and they see these two beams of fire heading towards them. The two beams split into four, right? And the four beams head directly towards these guys. Two beams of fire head towards each man. One beam goes into each nostril. The fire goes into their bodies, burns their bodies to a crisp from the inside out. And the clothing falls on the ground empty and untouched. End of scene. The Gemara then begins to ask the obvious question. This is a very strange death. What did these guys do to deserve this death? And the Gemara there goes through all sorts of interesting answers. So, one explanation which is given there is that Nadav and Avihu used to walk around behind their dad, Aaron, and their uncle, Moshe, and following them around, they used to say, gee, can't wait till Dad and Uncle Moshe drop dead so that we can lead the Jewish people. Okay, this is very, very strange. Here you have a couple of guys who, they're on such a high level that God himself calls them in the verse, Kadoshim. When I call someone a Kadosh, that doesn't mean very much. If my Rebbe called somebody Kadosh, that would be very significant. My Rebbe knows what a Kadosh is. If Rabbi Akiva from the Gemara would call somebody Kadosh, that would be extremely significant. But it's not Rabbi Akiva who called them Kadoshim. It was a Kadosh Baruch Hu, which means these guys were holding. Yes? Rabbi Akiva would not have been fit to shine their shoes. These guys were at a very high madrega. Why would anybody at such a high level of spiritual development ever do something as horrible as following around their father and their uncle saying, we can't wait till these guys drop dead so that we can lead the Jewish people? Would you ever do that to your father? To your uncle? Would you ever, could you utter such words? Could you imagine Rav Yashav uttering such words? These guys were so much bigger than Rav Yashav. How could they have said such a thing? Yeah, it says it's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Nun Beis Amud Aleph. The Gemara says, "Kvar hayu Moshe v'Aaron mahalchin b'derech." Moshe and Aaron were walking on the way. V'Nadav v'Avihu mahalchin achrehen. Nadav and Avihu were walking behind them. The Kol Yisrael achrehen. All the Jews were following Nadav and Avihu. By the way, again, you see these guys' status that all the Jews were following them. Amran lo Nadav l'Avihu. Nadav said to Avihu, when will these two old geezers drop dead? And you and I will lead the generation. It's far out. Okay. That's one of the reasons why they might have been put to death. Doesn't exactly explain why with two beams of fire, but a possible avera. Rashi, in the Chumash, describes another aveira they were involved in, which Rashi says is the reason they were killed. Rashi says, he quotes Rabbi Ishmael from the Gemara, Rashi says the problem that we mentioned before, they ran into the Mishkan, into Kadosh Kadoshim, drunk. Okay, now, this is really weird. Can you imagine me getting drunk before I come to the shir? Okay, now, you're laughing. Like, this is not, right, a shul. I'm not speaking of shul here. We're sitting in a dining hall. But I would never get drunk before coming in to teach ladies Torah in a dining hall. Can you imagine getting drunk before going to shul? Forget about a big tzaddik. An ordinary person in the streets, can you imagine getting drunk before he goes to shul? You would never do such a thing. Certainly you would never get drunk as preparations for going to shul. But these guys didn't go into a shul. Can you imagine the times of the Beis Hamikdash? We just walk down the hill, and then you can just walk across the ramp and go right there into the temple, right into the Beis Hamikdash. Now, can you imagine saying, listen, I got to be down there to bring a korban in about 45 minutes. Could you pass me the vodka, please? Can you imagine saying such a thing that you would actually get drunk? Can you imagine stepping foot on Harabai drunk? There's people who are afraid to touch the Kotel because of the Kedusha there. Can you imagine walking to Harabai drunk? You and I would never do it. Can you imagine Rav Yashiv getting drunk before he walks down the Har of Ice? Can you imagine Rav Yashiv getting drunk before he runs into the Kadosh Kadoshim? But this is not Rav Yashiv. This was not a Vavihu. So again, the bomb question is, how could they have gotten drunk before going into Kadosh Kadoshim? And apparently, the way that it's brought in the Gemara, it seems like it was some sort of a preparation for running to the Kadosh Kadoshim. Third question. Rashi says there's another reason why they were put to death. And that was, they paskined a shaila. They gave a Jewish halachic ruling in the presence of their Rebbe. There's a halacha, you're not allowed to issue a psak, a halachic ruling in your Rebbe's presence. According to the Gemara, it even seems like in your Rebbe's city, you shouldn't do it. And here, their Rebbe, it was the Rebbe of all of the Jews, all of Klal Yisrael, was Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe was there, and they issued a psak in front of him. What was the psak that they issued? So the Gemara says, the psak was, they ruled that they should put coals in fire pans and bring them to the Mizbeach, bring them to the altar. Now, this is very interesting, but if you would open up a Chumash and start to read, this makes no sense. Why? Because if you'll flip back just two or three pages before not even of you get killed, you'll find the following verse. And God spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the Kohanim, to not even of you, and tell them that they should put coals in fire pans and bring them to the altar. So not even of you weren't issuing a psak by bringing coals to the altar. They had been told by Moshe, they had been given explicit instructions two, three pages earlier, take the coals to the altar. So what does the Gemara mean that they issued a psak? And according to Rabbi Ishmael, according to Rabbi Eliezer, their psak was they should put coals in fire pans and take, but they were told to do that by Moshe. Fine. So, let's begin to take apart the questions now, and maybe we'll learn a little bit about what we're getting ready for during the month of intimacy. At Matan Torah, when the Torah was first given, the Jews were scared to death. God came down and ripped open the seven heavens, appeared in front of the entire Jewish people, right? Thunder, lightning, shaking mountain. Everybody was terrified. The Jews turned around and ran 12 miles in the other direction. God had to send angels to drag them back again. There's a strange verse in the Torah. In the midst of this whole scene, where all the Jews are shaking, they're terrified to be anywhere in the vicinity of this mountain. The verse says, God spoke to Moshe, who's on Mount Sinai, and told him, go down and warn those Kohanim to stay away from the mountain. They're going to get killed. It's dangerous while I'm sitting here, when I'm sitting here on the mountain. Tell those Kohanim to stay away. This is a very strange verse. Kohanim are going near the mountain. The Jewish people just turned and run 12 miles in the other direction. Right? And we assume it was all tribes that ran in the other direction. They were all terrified. They were terrified because of what was going on. The heavens, the lightning, the thunder. What kind of crazy people would be sitting near the mountain? So Chazal explained that there actually were Kohanim that were hanging out next to the mountain. Not most of the Kohanim. In fact, only two. One's name was Nadav, and the other's name was Avihu. And more! They weren't just hanging out next to the mountain. They were sitting there, right, with their feet kicked up on a chair, having a picnic. They were eating and drinking, the Pasuk says. They were eating and drinking. They were having a picnic next to Har Sinai in the middle of Matan Torah. Now, what were these guys doing? What was with them? More. The Targum Yonasan says that really, Nadav and Avihu received a death decree there while they were having the picnic at Har Sinai. It's just their death was put off until much later when they got fried in the Kadosh Kadoshim. What were these guys doing sitting there? So we have to understand. Nadav and Avihu had watched while Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron warned the people. And he said to the people, be careful. This is the Almighty. This is the master of the universe. You cannot make mistakes when you're dealing with him. And indeed, Moshe and Aaron, both inspired so much fear, so much awe in these people, that it sort of backfired. Moshe Rabbeinu said to them, I'll be back in 40 days, right? Look for me then. The only problem was the people weren't wearing cashios. And 40 days and 15 seconds later, according to their watches, Moshe Rabbeinu had not returned. And the people panicked. Why? Because they understood until then that the tzaddik can atone, a righteous person can atone for the sins of his community. Now, of course, the community still has to do a complete tshuva. They have to repent. They have to stop doing the bad things they're doing, etc. But through the tzaddik going through a hard time, by him suffering, so the community can survive long enough to do tshuva. The Jews understood that as long as Moshe Rabbeinu, their teacher, their tzaddik, was around, if they blew it, so Moshe would take the flak until they could do tshuva. And there was little danger of them being destroyed. But now, Moshe Rabbeinu was late. They had a vision that maybe he'd been killed. They saw a casket being carried through the sky. They thought maybe he was dead. And it occurred to them, oh boy, if anything just happened to Moshe Rabbeinu, we are in very big trouble. Because this God is a big guy. And if he gets angry, he could destroy us all. There was a panic, and so to replace Moshe Rabbeinu, they built another lightning rod. They built the golden calf. Why the golden calf? Because on the chariot, it's well known, there were on the Merkav, on the chariot, this vision that God descended in when he came down at Mount Sinai, there are four creatures. There's a person, there is an eagle, there is a lion, and there is a calf. So each one of these creatures represents a different aspect of the Almighty, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The calf represents Midas Hadin, the attribute of justice. The Jews understood that if they would make a mistake, the judgment, so to speak, would be issued forth, it would flow forth like a lightning bolt from the calf. Now, if you have a transmitter that's operating at 400 hertz, the receiver must receive on 400 hertz. If you have a transmitter that's transmitting on calf, the receiver has to be calf. So what they did was they built a lightning rod to receive Midas Hadin, to receive the judgment in case, God forbid, they blew it. But you see what happened here, because Moshe and Aaron scared the Jews. He made them so afraid of God. This is how Nadav and Avihu were thinking. They built the golden calf. They ended up walking right into disaster. Whose fault was that? They thought. Moshe and Aaron. And therefore, Nadav and Avihu walked around behind their father and their uncle out of love for the Jewish people, saying, we can't wait until Dad and Uncle Moshe die so that we can lead the Jews with love, not with Yira. Yira is dangerous. Now, Nadav and Avihu didn't realize that the reason that they didn't value Yira was they didn't possess it. Very often, the midos which we are most in possession of are the midos which we feel are the most important. And the midos we most lack, we think, well, that's not so important anyways. Nadav and Avihu had a problem. They lacked Yira. And because they lacked Yira, they didn't value it. Where do I see that Nadav and Avihu lacked Yira? Who were the two crazy guys who were sitting at Har Sinai making a picnic during Matan Torah? It was the two guys who weren't afraid. We'll go a step further. Excuse me. We're beginning to understand why Nadav and Avihu were sitting at the bottom of the mountain. We understand why Nadav and Avihu would have followed around their father and their uncle saying these terrible things. Out of love for the Jewish people, not out of hatred of their parents. Why did they get drunk? So, there is a time during the year when we Jews work on Yira. The day for working on Yira during our year is Yom HaKippurim. It's an awesome day. It's so awesome that on Yom Kippur you can't eat. It's not that the halacha prohibits you. It's how could you eat on Yom Kippur? It's a day when we're in such awe of the Almighty, we can't bring ourselves to. We can't do anything all day other than pray. How do we do an avodah in awe? So the avodah in awe involves an entire withdrawal from the physical world. There's no eating, there's no drinking. Most people on Yom Kippur do not sleep during the day. There is a withdrawal from anointing, from all physical pleasures. This is simultaneously a way of creating the Yira and a way of expressing the Yira. Now, almost exactly 6 months later, 180 degrees opposite the day for working on Yira, there is a day set aside for working on Ava. It's not Yom HaKippurim. Yom HaKippurim is the day which is like Purim. The day when we work on Ava is Purim itself. Now, let's be straight. Which one of these 2 days is the most important? Which is the highest of all these days? Yom Kippur or Purim? So there's no question that Purim is a higher day. Everyone agrees Purim is one of the most holy days of the entire year. Far transcends Yom Kippurim. But Yom Kippurim comes first. Working on Yira is the prerequisite to working on Ava, as we'll see shortly. When Purim finally arrives, there's a number of different things that we do to bring out Ahava. We give gifts. We make a suda. And we also drink. Nichnas yayin yotzi sod. One way of releasing the love inside is with a little sip of wine. A little sip of wine can help bring out all the love that's inside. And so, you understand why Nadav and Avihu who valued Ava, not Yira, who felt that Hashem should be served with love, not fear, not awe. So why they, Dafka, got drunk? Because the way that you serve Hashem with love is by having a drink. That's part of the avoda. They immediately grabbed fire pans, put the coals in the fire pans, and ran into the Kadosh Kadoshim. According to one opinion in the Gemara, their sin was they issued this ruling in front of their Rebbe. But what ruling did they issue? Moshe told them earlier, you're supposed to take fire, put it in the fire pans, and carry it to the altar. So, of course, the crucial point which I left out is that in the Mishkan, in the mobile temple, there were two altars. There was an external altar and the internal altar in the Kadosh Kadoshim in the Holy of Holies. Moshe Rabbeinu had told Nadav and Avihu, you should take fire, put it in fire pans, man-made fire, take this man-made fire and bring it to the external altar. When you put the fire on the external altar, then fire will come down from heaven. The God-made fire will mix in with the man-made fire and purify the man-made fire, turning the entire fire into a God-made fire. Then, this God-made fire may be brought from the external altar to the internal altar. In the Kadosh Kadoshim, the only thing that's allowed inside is the God-made fire, not the man-made. But not even Nadav and Avihu issued a psak in front of their Rebbe. They came up with a novel idea. And they took man-made fire and ran straight into the Kadosh Kadoshim. Why is that? The reason is because someone who doesn't value Yira, someone who doesn't value awesome, paralyzing respect, they don't see the difference between outsides and insides. They burst right in without knocking first. There's no respect. There's no waiting outside. And so, they ran straight into Kadosh Kadoshim, burst straight into the inside, even though they were not allowed. They were told to go to the outside. And immediately, two beams of fire headed for them. Burned them from the inside out, leaving their clothing intact. God made the statement loud and clear. Oh, you don't respect my insides? I won't respect your insides. Mida keneged mida, measure for measure, their insides were destroyed. Their outsides were left intact. The Torah provides many ladders that we can climb to build our character, to refine our midot, to refine our character traits. All of these ladders lead towards the perfect human being, and you can pick any ladder you want and just get on and start the climb. Many of the ladders include these two character traits, Ava, love, and Yira, awe. And in all the ladders that include those two character traits, Yira, awe, comes first, and then Ava, love, comes later. Okay, now, a crucial rule that we should always remember when we're working with these Midos ladders. When you're climbing a Midos ladder, you never take your foot off of one of the lower rungs. That is, you're always in contact with all of the rungs that you've climbed through. I'll give you an example. One of the most famous Midos ladders is listed in the Gemara in Avodah Zorah, Daf Chaf Amud Beis, and it's brought down in one of the most famous books, modern books, a book called The Path of the Just. Yeah? So there, the Gemara says, that Torah leads to something called zehirut. Zehirut is the state of not doing averus, of not actually violating God's will. If someone first starts to learn Torah, eventually, through their learning of Torah, they can actually stop doing destructive or self-destructive things. The third step in this ladder is zrizut. The Gemara there says, Torah leads to zehirus, zehirus leads to zrizus. Zrizus is a state where you're doing all the positive mitzvahs. So if you stop doing averas, the very next thing that'll happen is, if you keep going, you'll start doing all the mitzvahs. Now, let me ask you, Rebbe, could you just answer a question for me? I'm curious. After I've learned Torah, and I've actually stopped doing averas, can I then stop learning Torah? I have to keep learning? What about after I've stopped doing all the averas? Or better yet, and I've started doing the positive mitzvahs now. I moved all up to the third level. I'm doing all the positive mitzvahs. Can I now go back and start doing averas again? No, of course not. As you climb up the ladder, you have to hang on to all the previous rungs in the exact same way. When you move into the world of intimacy, when you move into the world of Ahava, you have to hold on to the awesome respect that came in the previous stages. Aaron went in to the Kadosh Kadoshim and begged, please, please, Hashem, bring fire down from heaven. Now, I left out part of the scene. Initially, Aaron was terrified to go in. And Moshe had to push him. The verse in the Torah says, Krav el Mizbeach! Go up to that Mizbeach! Go in there, Moshe said to him. So the Gemara is curious. The Gemara doesn't understand why is Moshe Rabbeinu telling Aaron again, go? A couple of verses earlier, he already told him to go. Why is he telling him again? And the Midrash fills in with the following story. Very interesting metaphor. The Gemara says, what can this be compared to? This problem that Aaron was having going into the Kadosh Kadoshim to do his work. It's like a king of flesh and blood who marries a wonderful woman. She had always dreamed of marrying the king. And she went on the shidduch, they liked each other, worked out, right? They got married. And now the time had come. They were about to go to the yichud room. V'hayta mitbayeshet milafanov. But she was embarrassed to go into the yichud room. She was afraid. V'nichnasa achota etzla. So her sister came to encourage her. What did her sister say? Amrla. She said, Hama nichnast l'davar zeh. Why did you get involved in this in the first place? Why did you say yes when the king asked you if you would marry him? Elish tisham shit the melech. Isn't the reason that you got involved so that you could be with the king? So you could be close to him. You could be his partner. That you could connect him. Isn't that the whole purpose? So if that's the purpose, so then why are you hesitating now? Higisi daitech literally inflates your das. Make yourself intimate with him. Be closer to him. Uboy v'shimshiyat ha-melech, and then go in and be with the king. Kach amar Moshe la'aron. This is what Moshe said to Aaron. Aaron achi, Aaron my brother. Amar nivbacharta liot kohen gadol. Why did you agree to be the kohen gadol? Why were you chosen for this in the first place? Why did you take this responsibility? Isn't it so that you can serve the king? Isn't it to achieve this closeness, this intimacy? Isn't this the whole goal? Higis daitcha. Inflate your das. Go become close to him. Become intimate with him. Uba v'aved avodasecha. Go, do your avoda. So Aaron went in. And the reason the fire didn't come down initially was Aaron was working on his midos. Yira he had. The time had come for him to create Ahava. And he was in there doing an avoda, falling in love with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Do we have any hint that he actually pulled it off? That Aaron actually succeeded eventually in achieving Ava? So, if you know a little halacha and you read the verses carefully, you see that he made it. How? There is a halacha that Aaron and his descendants, at least minimally once a day, must give a blessing to the Jews. And you must do it standing up, out loud, with your hands outstretched. Birkas Kohanim, the blessing of the priests. There's another halacha that you are not allowed to give that blessing unless you are feeling ava. The words that those Kohanim say when they get ready to say the blessing is, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Asher Kidushanu B'Kedushas Shel Aaron V'Tzivanu, right? Levarech es Amo Yisrael Be'Ahava, right? We're supposed to give a bracha to Klal Yisrael Be'Ahava. Immediately after the scene, fire comes down, Aaron comes out of the Kadosh Kedoshim, and the first thing he does is Birkas Kohanim, which shows you he actually had achieved Ava. He had mastered this Madrega. By the way, I won't go into this in great detail. Perhaps we'll speak about this more as Purim approaches. But there's a very interesting scene, which as soon as you take a look at the scene, you'll realize it's not coincidentally parallel. There was a time when Esther Hamalka was also afraid to go and be with the king. And the Moshe Rabbeinu of that generation, Mordechai, came to her and said to her, go in and be with the king. Right? And when you go back to that scene and take a look, there he told her that she should wear Malchus. And the Mefarshim there explained that was Ruach HaKodesh. Just as Aaron, before he was allowed to go into the Kadosh Kedoshim, was supposed to put on the breastplate that also had Nevuah associated with it. The parallels are exactly precise, and the reason is because the exact same thing was going on in both places. Ulai Purim will speak about that more. Let's start to move towards the practical. There is a tragically widespread belief that Ava and Yira are mutually exclusive opposites. That if you really want to achieve what we in the West love, which is intimacy, you have to move away from that horrible quality called Yira. What place could there possibly be in a close relationship for something called Yira? Of course, once we define what the word yira means, the word yira does not mean pachad. Pachad is terror. Yira is from the word ro'eh, to see. Yira is when you see so clearly the greatness of the other that you are paralyzed with awe. I think I've told you the story before that I met my wife in a very unusual sort of environment. We had both, we didn't know each other, and we had applied independently to participate in a summer seminar on making the world a better place. It was a seminar for college students from English-speaking countries across the world, and there were only 80 slots, and the competition was extremely competitive, and we had both applied for this program, and we had both been accepted. Now, the program was highly structured, and the goal was that over a 30-day period, all 80 people would get to talk to each other and suck out of each other ideas for how to make the world a better place. So, to make the program work, one of the rules was no pairing off. Not man-man, not woman-woman, not man-woman. They didn't care if it was romantic or not romantic. They didn't want you to spend 2 or 3 days with one person because you only had 30 days to get to know all 80 people on the program. So, wouldn't you know, when I show up at the program, I sit down, in the first 10 minutes of the program, I sit down across from this lady, and I'm like, oh, it's my wife, okay, my wife-to-be. But I had signed a contract saying I would not pair off, which I would have been more than willing to pair up at that point, but I was on the program already. So I kept the rules. And for 30 days, I only interacted with her in a professional, non-romantic fashion. My wife told me I was the only one on the program who kept the rules, right? Everyone else was looking. But I kept the rules. Okay. So I remember it was the 30th day, it was the last day, and the program ended at noon, and I remember at 12:01, excuse me, can I talk to you for a second? Right, I walked around, you know, can we go out? And we went out, and it was the most unusual date I'd ever been on. Yeah, because for 30 days I had gotten to know this lady in a deep way, understanding her vision of the world and her understanding of what a human being is, and it was a 30-day shidduch in the secular world. An intense 24-hour-a-day 30-day shidduch in the secular world. When I went out with her, the end of this whole program, I was not a religious Jew at the time. I did not touch her. I didn't hold her hand. A week went by, 2 weeks went by. I didn't touch her on the shoulder. I did her for a full month without ever touching this woman. Yeah? 2 months. 3 months. I'm a normal, healthy, secular boy at this point, yes? 6 months I dated her. I didn't touch her hand. Nothing. Why? Because I had such awesome respect for her. She is the most awesome person I've ever met in my life. And because she's so awesome, I felt like it would have been cheap. I felt like it would have been degrading in a way. We weren't there to recreationally enjoy each other. We had something deep happening. There was tremendous respect. So this continued and continued and continued. And 4 years later, we got married. 4 years later. This was not easy. But it created a relationship which, in the secular world, is very unusual. A relationship of tremendous awe, of literally paralyzing respect, of almost a trembling, not quite, but almost a trembling when you approach, because you have such deep respect for the other. I will confess, 2.5 years into the relationship, I actually did touch her accidentally. What happened? We were standing in line for a movie. And it was one of these midnight movies, and there was a long line, and they had to move the line across the street. And as the line was moving across the street, I saw a car coming. So I reached out to grab her hand to move her out of the way. It was the first time, yes, I had ever come into physical contact with her. When I touched her hand, I almost passed out. My wife said I was hyperventilating. She had to help me across the street to get to the other side, yeah? Yeah? This is what happens if you add a drop of intimacy in to a base of awesome respect. And this is what God had in mind. This is the whole goal. That there should be a tremendous base of yira. That's the first step. Once there's a tremendous base of yira, then you can add in a tidbit of intimacy and it explodes. There's an older woman who I've... a very wise older woman who I've spoken to before. And she made the funny statement to us a while back. She said, young people, they don't know how to have sex. Now what was she speaking about? She said that this is not what God had in mind, what goes on today. This is not what he had in mind. They're all missing out. The way a relationship is supposed to work is it's supposed to start with awesome, awesome respect. Then from there, when you can't walk into the room that he or she is in without knocking first, from there, you can then move to the next madriga. Now I just want to issue a warning to stay away from something which could be dangerous, and you could misunderstand what I'm saying and get involved in something very dangerous. The Chazon Ish made the statement that there is no place for what he called charedet derech eretz in a relationship between man and wife. Trembling derech eretz, meaning that the relationship should not be so formal that there isn't room for playfulness. Yeah, the relationship has to be a playful relationship. And we're not advocating here the sort of formal relationship that you would have relating to the Gadol Hador or something like that. That can't exist between you and your husband. It has to be a playful, close, intimate relationship. All the Torah is displaying for us here is that there is an aspect of yirah that also has to be present in every ideal relationship. Not that it should be overwhelming, you should be afraid to approach, etc., but that there should be a deep, deep respect in the relationship as well. And what is the source of this respect? You see it in the word. Yirah from the word ro'eh. The more that you see the other, the more you'll come to respect them. The more that you pay attention to who they are, to their godless, the more you'll come to respect them. Kavod will be a response to Yira. Kavod will be a response to Yira. So now, let's begin to move away from the husband-wife relationship and towards our relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. First, I just point out, by the way, one of the areas where many people are most nichshel, they have the most difficulty in maintaining the respect and then adding into that the intimacy, is with kids. Yeah, we expect our kids to always respect us. But the idea of actually respecting children, so that's something that's sort of absent. A child came to my door this morning. My kids are out of the house. And he knocked on the door and he said, can I use... my kids all chipped together and they bought a scooter. So they said, can we use the kid's scooter? So I said, they're not home right now. So said, I know, I just want to use the scooter. So I said, well, they're not home, I can't ask them. And he said, well, you're the Abba, you can decide. And I said, well, I could if it was mine, but it's theirs. So, but he says, but you own everything that they own. He said, maybe I'll pay halacha, but this is in their rishus, this belongs to them. I would have to ask them before I could give it to you. Yeah? So he looked at me like I was crazy, this kid. You know, like, what's wrong with you? But, I mean, obviously, while I am the Abba, and as the Abba, I have a certain authority in the house. But that authority in no way detracts from the respect that I can show for my children. Yeah? It's also okay when you ask your child to pass the ketchup to say please. Yeah? That's part of respect. Yeah? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To knock on the child's door before coming into the child's room. This is an area that is for some reason ignored today. And it's very, very important we teach our children to honor their mother and father. I'm not detracting from that. I'm just saying that there is also a concept of respecting children and that sometimes gets lost in the intimacy. We're so close to them that we sometimes don't put enough energy into the respect. And real intimacy is built when there's respect. Elul is coming. It's the time of Ani L'do Diva D'o D'idli. This is the period when we're going to draw close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But there's a Seder, there's an order here. Which is why, in the yeshivas, in Europe, if you would say to somebody, Elul is coming, they would turn white. There are stories about children misbehaving in the streets, in Kelm, and a Rav would walk by and whisper to them, it's Elul. And they would stop misbehaving. Because in Elul, there was a certain awe that was created. Why is there awe in Elul in the month of Ani L'do Diva D'o D'li? So that's fairly clear, because the way that you create that intimacy, the way that you get the relationship that God wants, is through this awe. From the first day of Elul, we already want to be in the mindset that most people don't achieve until Yom Kippur. From the first day of Elul, we want to be feeling an awe, an awesome, paralyzing respect for the master of the universe, for the Almighty. Practically, we're going to be taking a break for about 2 weeks now. So, in this break, the sort of thing you want to be doing now is start to think about the fact that he is the one who keeps all life going. That everything you need, you get it from him. Whether it's financial lack or emotional needs, whether it's Torah, whatever the things are that you want in your life. So all of those things come from him or don't come from him. It all depends on him. And life on this planet can be hell or heaven, depending on him. So the idea here is just to realize who he is. Look at what he controls. Look at the massive power you're dealing with. Ulai, if we can walk into Elul with the appropriate sense of awe, then as Elul proceeds, then together as a group we'll be able to work on finding that little pinch of intimacy and finding how to throw it in to make the whole thing go. Questions? Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Every time you eat, you drink, you walk, between now and Elul, start getting yourself ready so that when Elul hits, the only thing in your mind is, he is awesome. Okay, we'll stop here. Have a good day.